welcome and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with Wild Weather. We hear Chris Field, David Freeberg, Karen O'Brien, and Michael Oppenheimer talk about the extreme weather of 2011. In the U.S. alone, a dozen disasters caused more than $1 billion in damage. One area acutely threatened by the climate change is food production, where decades of steady gain could be reversed. And then after that, we go on to an analysis of the NDAA. What is in the National Defense Authorization Act that President Obama recently signed into law, accompanied by a signing statement? Dyla Lithwick explains the bill's content. She is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate, where she specialized in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues.
Welcome to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. Today we're discussing extreme weather, Snowmageddon, epic floods along the Mississippi River, Hurricane Irene, Snowtober. Weather is definitely wild and crazy these days. The U.S. government reports that 2011 had a record number of disasters causing more than $1 billion in damage. The number of incidents rose to 12, up from the previous high of 9 in 2009. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says the increases are attributed to rising population along the coasts, more insurable property, and more extreme storms. For the next hour, we'll discuss the science and economics of freak weather in the United States and around the world with four experts, as well as our live audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Joining us, we're delighted to welcome Chris Field, Director of the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford. We have Dave Freeberg, who's founder and CEO of the Climate Corporation, a startup company that helps farmers manage weather risk. Karen O'Brien is a professor of sociology and human geography from the University of Oslo, and Michael Oppenheimer is a professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton. We should mention that Chris Field, Karen O'Brien, and Michael Oppenheimer are here in town participating in an IPCC authors meeting, a group of scientists that just created a new report on extreme weather around the world. Please welcome them to Climate One. Chris Field, let's begin with you. You're a leader in the UN panel on climate change, and there's a new report on extreme weather. What's the headline? What's the takeaway from the research on extreme weather around the world?
Our special report on extreme events and disasters really reached three main conclusions. The first is that extreme events are increasing. Extremes of high temperature, heavy precipitation, droughts, and things that are associated with high sea levels. The second key conclusion is that losses are increasing, as you've already described for the U.S. It's mainly because there's more stuff in the way of the extreme weather. And the third, probably the most important message, is there's a lot we can do about it. There's smart things that don't necessarily cost a lot that can be protective of assets and protective of lives.
Okay, so there's more happening, more in the way, and there's things we can do about it. Michael Oppenheimer, anything to add there in terms of what the headline is, in terms of IPCC doesn't create new science, but they assess what's in the literature?
Sure. I would add just 2 points. Scientists are killjoys in a way. Everybody has a lot of fun with the weather, and everything that goes wrong seems to be due to climate change. But in fact, we've tried to be very careful about it. And there are three things, and Chris mentioned some of them, that we're having, that you're quite familiar with, that are changing. The frequency of very hot days and heat waves. Very heavy precipitation events. My basement flooded twice last summer, once from Hurricane Irene, and once from a storm that nobody heard of before that hit us with 7 inches. I live in New York City in the space of 24 hours, which for that part of the world is a lot. And extremes of high seas, extreme high seas along the coast are increasing. That's partly due to the fact that the sea level is rising. So when you put that together, the climate is changing, and we have to learn how to deal with it. And the good news, as Chris said, is there are a lot of specific examples of where we have been successful. We're falling behind right now. But actually, in certain places, at certain times, people have done a very good job. For instance, heat wave deaths, when the governments in charge pay attention to it, it's possible to avoid by a factor of 10 or 100, to reduce by that much the number of people that die in heat waves. That's been the history recently in Europe, where up to 40,000 people died in a heat wave in 2003. A similar, although smaller scale, heat wave hit France a few years later. The death rates were down by 100. So there are things we can do. We ought to be doing them now.
And we'll get to the human response later, but I want to pick up on sea level rise, because I thought that was something that was like 2100, and you're talking about the impacts of sea level rise today.
Well, one of the things where we have high confidence in is that the sea level has already risen about 7 inches over the last century, and the rise is continuing, and we know why. Water is a fluid. When you heat it, like we're heating the sea, it expands. Ice, like glaciers, is melting, and the big ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica also appear to be adding water to the sea. That's happening now, and that's something we have to deal with now. If you live in a coastal city like this one, it's having an effect already.
Karen O'Brien, there's some things that humans are doing that are increasing the risk and vulnerability, and that was your part of the report. Tell us about how we're doing dumb things that are making this worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of times we think of, I'm interested in who's vulnerable, who's going to be affected, and a lot of the vulnerability is actually related to social policies and our lack, as Michael said, of preparedness or of ways of actually reducing our risk through social actions. And so there's a lot of things that we actually can do for disaster risk reduction and climate adaptation that would help us be better off in the future, given that we know that the risks are changing now.
Great, and we'll get to some examples later. David Freeberg, you are not a scientist. Your business, you have a startup company that's based on some of the science here, some of the scientific trends. Tell us what you're doing and how you're connecting science with farmers and in the commercial markets.
So we sell a product that insures farmers against bad weather events. So we monitor the weather on a very localized basis. A farmer will buy an insurance policy from us, and if certain weather events occur that will cause an impact on the yield of that farmer's crop, we will send the farmer a check. Effectively insuring them against lost crop yield as a result of weather events. And so to do that, we are simulating the weather on a very local basis for the next several years, trying to determine what the distribution of outcomes might be, and that's how we determine what prices we should charge to insure against weather events.
And a lot of this is based on IPCC science, or is it based on, to what extent are you using the science?
So I would say we generally build our models on a climatological approach. So we use a variety of statistical methods to determine what the distribution of outcomes can be, and there are indicators that are applied to those models, including trends and other trending forecasts that folks are developing, as well as seasonal indicators like La Nina and El Nino and so on, which also play a role because we're a little more short range in terms of the modeling that we're doing. We're not modeling 10 to 20 years out, we're modeling the next 1 to 2 years.
And that's often a debate with climatologists who like to have a couple of decades of data before they will predict a trend, and people don't buy insurance that way. So let's talk about the time frame here. You need something that's really immediate, and these researchers like to think in decades or preferably millennia, right? Michael?
10 or 20 years is a short time to conclude anything. I personally like a run of 30, 40, 50 years of data. And in some cases, we have that. I mean, there's one weather station that's from the mid-1600s. But really good temperature data, for instance, comes from the middle of 2 centuries ago, the 19th century. But with other features of the climate, like hurricanes, we don't have a long string of good data. So wrestling to the ground, how much is the human influence and how much is natural can be very difficult.
That's a question. Chris Field?
Just going to say, with this new report, a lot of what we tried to grapple with is what are the responses and the consequences of current variability, exactly the kinds of things that David is dealing with, and how is this going to change in the future. And we have good information based on the information that is available, mostly over the last 100 years or so, on what the trends look like. The climate models allow us to have reasonably high confidence in changes in some of the extremes, and that was really one of the key features in the new report is projection showing that extremes of high temperature drought and heavy precipitation will increase in the future, in coming decades, maybe not in the time frame that David's modeling now, but in the future, so that when we're building long-term infrastructure like levee systems or causeways or bridges, we really ought to be aware of these. And one of the great challenges and one of the really exciting consequences of doing this report is we had a chance to think about, well, what are the implications of things we do now for things that we also need to be doing in the decades out into the future?
So let's drill a little bit into the high temperature, coastal flooding, things that we can relate to here in California. That's one of those areas where, as well as extreme rain and droughts, those are areas where there's high confidence that those things are actually increasing because of man-made climate change. Is that right?
We can be confident that extremes in high temperatures and extremes in heavy precipitation have a clear fingerprint of human effects already. It's a little less clear for the droughts. Droughts tend to have a very large component that's due to water management and a bunch of other things that you can only see the consequences of on a long period. But the attribution is, as we call it in the climate science business, who can you blame, is clear for the trends in heat waves and heavy precipitation. That doesn't mean we can attribute a single event to climate change, but the trends we know.
So you can't. We can't say, and no one up here will say, we caused Hurricane Irene.
That's correct.
Would you say that...
We cannot say that.
We increased the probability of something like Hurricane Irene, and it happened.
With hurricanes, it's a little difficult, but with other features of the climate system, that's the way to look at it. How would the chances increase? It's a roll of the dice.
The load of the
and
dice.
If the roll of the dice used to be 1 in 6, maybe now it's 1 in 5, 1 in 4, or 1 in 3.
And what has been the popular mainstream media reaction to this report? The report's not fully out yet, but it was covered a few weeks ago. It was released at the United Nations summit in South Africa. How did it get played?
I think it got very good coverage.
Michael Oppenheimer, yeah, or Chris Field?
The news on the report was leaked when New York City had its freak snowstorm in October, and the leak basically let people see that there was a connection between extremes and real impacts on real people.
It's nothing like an event that hits the media establishment on the Upper West Side of New York to kind of think, oh, this is really happening. Yes.
We're willing to take advantage of symbolism to help us make the points in the report.
We used to have a saying in the news business that the story is what the editor sees on the way to work in the morning. And, when the subway's flooding, it kind of drives it home. Any other thoughts on the media coverage, how it was played? So much of the media has been dominated lately about skepticism about the science that you do and people, saying that, well, you're Michael Oppenheimer.
Well, given that the message is a sort of complicated, is a complicated one in a way. That is, it's not about... necessary. There's, more killer storms. It's a more subtle message about what can you do to defend yourselves and ourselves. I thought it got very good and very accurate coverage. I didn't see any big exaggerations like we're all going to die tomorrow. I think maybe the media, some parts of the media, is getting a little more sophisticated about dealing with this problem.
Karen O'Brien, you're in Europe. You probably have a little bit of a different perspective. How did it play in Europe?
It was we've had a really warm winter in some parts of Europe. In Norway, we didn't get snow until last week. And when the report came out, Norway, who doesn't necessarily think it's vulnerable to extreme events, actually experienced a hurricane on the west coast that cost billions and blew off roofs of houses and things. So it really, extreme weather is something that people feel, they see, they turn on the news, and they look at Thailand, they look at what's going on around the world. So it really did receive a lot of attention and a lot of interest.
David, any thoughts on the media? Do you have the media coverage of it?
No, we purposefully avoid a lot of the discussions about...
You're very data-driven.
Causality, yeah. Right. So mm-hmm. I would say that we're not as interested in identifying root causes of trends and signals in changing climate and changing weather patterns. We're more interested in modeling them and helping to protect against them occurring with our product. So our customers are farmers. Farmers will simply tell you the weather is changing. It's not what it used to be.
They don't care why. It's just like, it's changing. I got to protect against it.
Yeah, I purposefully avoid the discussion about why. I would say farmers know that it's changing, and they're trying to figure out what to do about it. And in parts of the country, it's changing to the extent that it's requiring a change in behavior. Texas, it's very difficult to farm right now. There's a significant drought that's persisting, and farmers simply can't grow their crops like they used to in Texas. So it could be that they may not be able to farm in Texas for the near term.
But let's talk a little bit about the costs of this. I mean, some of this cost is being borne by taxpayers. I believe 2011 was a high year in terms of federal crop insurance, right? Is that true?
Yeah, the most expensive year, I think, estimates are over $12 billion is what it's going to cost the U.S. taxpayer for the federal crop insurance program, 2011.
Compared to a normal year is what, $8
billion? Well, it's driven partially by commodity prices, but 10 years ago it would have been about one-sixth that cost or one-fifth that cost.
And so that's one reason. There are lots of reasons for driving up food prices. So are the kinds of things that these scientists are here talking today are going to affect the food prices of everyone here in the audience? Or there's going to be...
Well, if you think about it, so prices are driven by supply. And so go back a few years, the supply for the wheat crop globally was decimated not by a single weather event, but by several extreme weather events occurring globally around the same time. So there was an extreme drought in Russia around the same time that there was extreme flooding in Australia, two major wheat production markets. And so that year, there was a very significant wheat shortage, and a lot of folks have speculated that the Arab Spring may have been driven by a food shortage
sparked by that.
Or insurmountable food prices as a result of wheat supplies being significantly diminished. So I think what we see globally is you may have a good year, you may have another good year, but globally, food supplies are going to be affected by volatility in production output each year, and that's going to affect the global supply of food, And as a result, prices are going to go up.
Can global supply expand?
So
normally, if the price of something goes up, the more suppliers enter the market.
Yeah, well, this becomes a little bit self-serving. We believe that crop insurance can actually serve a need for, or weather insurance can serve a significant need in helping to expand agricultural development. There are some estimates that say that there's over 80 million acres of arable land in Brazil that go undeveloped each year because local farmers simply can't afford to take on the weather risk associated with farming. They might have a good season, but there's a 1 in 4 chance that they get completely wiped out. So to borrow money from the bank, put their families at risk and risk going bankrupt is simply too much of a risk for them to take on to actually go out and farm the land. Now, there have been some trial programs that the UN, through the World Food Program, put on recently in Kenya where they were able to encourage agricultural development, get local farmers to farm by giving them free crop insurance. So there is effectively this concept where if you take the risk of the weather out of farming, you can start to encourage agricultural development, expand the global food supply. But it's a very costly and challenging effort to undertake globally.
Any other thoughts on that? Whether the science you're talking about is going to affect global food supply, Chris Field?
Well, there are several things you can do to address global food supply. You can clear new land. You can invest in technology in order to increase yields on the land that's already arable. But what we see is that as whatever kind of investments you make, you tend to get more and more sensitive to the volatility. Even when you invest more in fertilizer and mechanization, what you tend to do is find yourself more sensitive to the weather. So there really is no way to escape the problem of variability and how you deal with it.
So having Michael up another?
Yeah, there is some evidence for the U.S. in particular. There's one study done at Stanford that shows, that argues that the climate changes that have already occurred have had a significant effect on productivity. So that the productivity growth has fallen below what it would have been otherwise because of the effect of climate change.
But I've heard some people say that the warming actually makes certain climates hospitable to agriculture that weren't before, right? As things go, crops can move to the north, that might expand the arable land.
There is an interesting question about the winners and losers. Some areas are probably going to lose pretty soon. Some areas may win for a while. And how that'll balance out is uncertain. It probably means global food supply isn't threatened by climate change on the whole, but we don't have a global food supply. We have certain people in certain places that even today, when there's globally enough food, don't get the food. So this is another pressure that will be added to a system which already sees people sort of falling through the cracks.
I should point out that a lot of the predictions we have of who the winners and losers are going to be are based on average changes in average conditions rather than on extreme events. So we don't know how pests, changes in pests and diseases of crops and those extreme rainfalls that happen in the summer will affect it. And Norway, which thinks that warmer temperatures will benefit agriculture, has had extreme rains in the summer. So the cows don't get enough to eat. So we don't have butter this Christmas, and we have to import butter. And it's had a lot of unpredictable impacts on the so-called winners.
The techno-optimists would say that we can genetically design crops that will be more drought-resilient and that sort of thing. Maybe David Friedberg, is that your customers maybe working on that, right? That might not be so good for your business, but it might be good for the
It's good farmer. For the world. Monsanto publicly stated that they think they can get to 300 bushel corn in the next 10 to 15 years.
300 bushels per acre, which is
I mean, today you're looking at 200 bushels, and 20 years ago we were 100 bushels, which is... So it's pretty significant continued improvements. Now, they're drought-resistant corn, may or may not,
Which you have to buy every year from Monsanto, probably.
Yeah, and I would say that the problem with drought-resistant corn is that there's certain drought conditions that it's resistant to, and there's certain drought conditions that it's not. And so it's not necessarily been tested in a production scale way yet to see how it works.
I should make a pitch for farmers. Over the last 50 years, global food production has increased by 1-2% per year in almost a clock-like way. And it's been very spectacular. It's meant that there were millions of acres that we didn't have to cut down forests, and it's meant that food prices were going down over much of that period. It's really a remarkable accomplishment at the global scale. But there are a number of indications that food production is threatened in the future. Partly I see food security as kind of at the heart of a perfect storm. There's climate change, the issue we've been talking about. There's a population that continues to grow. There's a big demand for an increase in using farmland for the production of biomass energy. And there also was a dramatic increase in the preference of people around the world for meat-based diets, all of which mm-hmm. requires more cropland per person. You put all those things together, and we're going to need to get every bit of yield increase we can get in the future.
And let's talk about water, because water is kind of, you know, trickling through all of this. I don't know how you addressed water specifically. Well, you've been talking about extreme weather events. There's both too much and not enough water. But did you really sort of dial in on water? Because a lot of people think that that's where climate will come home to some people first. They'll feel the water impacts most directly in their lives.
Probably in California, that's right. California has always been short of water, and many of the implications of climate change are decreasing the water security for California, particularly through its effect on the snowpack. But worldwide, we're seeing a trend both in the fraction of the rainfall that falls in the heaviest precipitation events. That's been true across much of North America, Northern Europe. But we're also seeing an increase in the duration and the intensity of droughts in many parts of the world, including in the southwest of the U.S. and in much of Africa. And
dust bowl conditions now in particular, close
well,
to dust
I mean,
bowl.
Whether they're dust bowl or not, they're very tough conditions for making a living as a farmer. And the projections are that those will continue to increase. And it makes it really clear that we're not looking at uniform patterns everywhere. Some places wetter, some places drier.
And that's hard to get across. People say, oh, it snowed in Washington, or it snowed, global warming, hooey, right? It's hard to get that nuance across. It is both more and less hot and cold. That's a tough thing to communicate.
Absolutely.
I can change the world with my own two hands, make it a better place. With my own two hands, make it a kinder place. With my own two hands, with my own, with my own two hands. I can make peace on earth with my own two hands. I can clean up the earth with my own two hands. I can reach out to you with my own two hands, with my own, with my own two hands, with my own, with my own two hands. I'm gonna make it a brighter place with my own two hands. I'm gonna make it a safer place with my own two hands. I'm gonna help the human race with my own two hands, with my own, with my own two hands, with my own, with my own two hands. Hold you in my own two hands, and I can comfort you with my own two hands. But you got to use your own two hands, use your own, use your own two hands, use your own, use your own.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And now for something completely different.